As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
But we're not talking about that today, nor even my mustache, but instead this theme of Stoicism and its encounter with Christian philosophy. And the specific context in which I want to do this is by introducing to you a thinker whom probably at least some, maybe most of you have heard of before, but probably few of you have actually read, and that is Boethius and his famous Consolation of Philosophy. I saw some jazz hands there.
Yes.
So just to help me out, can I get, with a show of hands, how many have read the Consolation of Philosophy before?
Not halfway.
Good. Okay. That's helpful. That's helpful. Boethius was not a Stoic philosopher, though he admired Stoicism very much and incorporated Stoic themes into his own Christian philosophy, and that's what we'll be talking about in the second half of the talk tonight. In the first half, I would like to say a little bit about Stoicism and why it's worth thinking about now, what I think is valuable about it, and what I think is not so good about it. And then I want to introduce Boethius and suggest that Boethius retains everything that is worth retaining about Stoicism, but then improves on the things that need improving. And so I'll close with a sort of recommendation that you read Boethius yourself, or if you are not motivated to do that, read a sort of general audience, popular level commentary on Boethius or introduction to his thought, this book, After Stoicism. I wrote the book because I had been noticing that, I would see essays, short, long, recommending Stoicism for confronting various modern problems. I saw some of these in the COVID era, how to deal with lockdowns, how to deal with the social isolation, the uncertainty of the COVID era. There were several essays I read recommending Stoic practices, Stoic discipline, Stoic apathy as a way of coping with those traumas. But I really, the more I looked into this, the more I realized that the sort of modern renaissance, if you will, of Stoic thought goes back, call it a period of, say, 12 to 15 years. And it really is sort of in the area we're now in, these Silicon Valley types who are turning to Stoic thinkers as a way to deal with what they think of as some of their problems. What are these? Well, the isolation of technology, the intense pace of work to get ahead in your profession. You have to have a certain kind of discipline over your desires in order to have that single-minded focus to succeed at the highest levels of whatever profession you want to succeed at. And so many young tech professionals turn to Stoicism as a way to help them with those ends. I think it's interesting that the Stoic Renaissance coincides almost perfectly with the ubiquity of smartphones. So right around the time, say 2010, 2012, when everyone had an iPhone or a smartphone, right around that time, there's this kind of turn to Stoicism. Why is that? I suggest it's because smartphones and the sort of broader technology they represent have a combination of fostering a kind of social isolation and also compulsive behavior. Whether that's just doom scrolling, whether that's sort of mindless looking at articles, whether that's video games or worse things that you can get up to on the internet on your phone. The experience of the phone and related technologies is often experienced as a compulsion. And to be compelled to do anything is a kind of degrading way to live. To have this very helpful tool, but to be enslaved to it at the same time, is a degrading, debased form of life. And I think many people recognize that, even if they don't have the self-discipline to overcome that compulsion. The Stoic philosophy of cultivating apathy, removing ourselves or detaching ourselves from the things that don't really matter and making sort of healthy use of them to accomplish our own ends. That Stoic theme is perhaps welcome news to people who are feeling the degradingness of their compulsions. And similarly, the Stoic idea that our relationships with other people, close friendships, close family relationships, only set us up for heartache because people will either let you down or they will die, or both. And so we can't get ourselves too involved in close relationships. So there's the isolation that our technology fosters is okay because other people aren't worth the effort. But the compulsion that our technology fosters, maybe there's a way out of that through the cultivation of Stoic discipline and Stoic apathy. So I suggest that those are among the reasons why more people today are becoming interested in Stoicism. Another way of tracking the rise of interest is the quantity of books about Stoicism published over the last 15 years, the quantity and the very high sales numbers of some of these books. The most famous of these Stoic popularizers is a guy named Ryan Holiday. And whenever I've lectured on Boethius and Stoicism, I always have at least one person who has been influenced by Holiday's contemporary Stoic popularization. So another show of hands. Any Ryan Holiday readers? Yeah, two, yeah, three, four, yeah. And that's all to the good. I think there's a lot of value there for those of us who are academic philosophers, especially historians of philosophy. You look at Ryan Holiday with that sort of lens, and it's a little bit cringeworthy, but looked at from, I think, a more generous lens, I think what he's up to and others, I think it's a very good service to people who are looking to the past for some sort of answers about how to live here and now. So, what is Stoicism? It's a school of an ancient school of philosophy that begins in ancient Greece. People who most of you probably have not heard of before, Zeno of Citium and Chrysippus, but the Roman Stoics are the ones that we tend to remember most today, Seneca, Epictetus, and probably most famously, Marcus Aurelius, because we've all seen the Russell Crowe movie, Gladiator. And the idea with Stoicism, if you asked Cicero, is simply this. Cicero said, well, the Stoics just took everything good that Aristotle and Plato taught about ethics, and they made up words and tried to make it sound more complicated. So Cicero had this sort of cynical attitude about the Stoics. But the Stoics themselves, the way that they thought of themselves, at least the Roman Stoics, their idea was a little different from the eudaimonism of Aristotle. Both Aristotle and Plato tell us that the thing that we act for, the thing that we can't help but act for, is our own happiness. We really, really want to be happy, and everything we do is somehow ordered toward that end. Even if we're doing it badly, that's still the thing we're aiming at. The Stoics, by contrast, thought that while we do indeed have an end, like something that we're going for, the good life, it wasn't so much happiness that they wanted, that they recommended we try to cultivate. Not happiness, but tranquility. Tranquility. It's a kind of absence of pain, an absence of suffering. If you can achieve that, the absence of suffering, you have achieved the highest human good. How do you do that? You have to cultivate virtue. You have to recognize that the only thing that really matters is, happens to be the only thing that is truly under your control, which is your character. So your possessions, your relationships with other people, pleasures of the flesh, social status, political power, all of these goods are false goods. At best, they are merely indifferent. Some might be more preferable than others, all else being equal. But none of these external goods, or goods of fortune, are truly goods. They're just not good. They're at best preferred indifference. If we can recognize that they're not truly good, that they can't truly bring us the tranquility we seek, then we can turn within and recognize that if we cultivate a certain kind of character, we can reliably resist attraction to these false goods. So the classical virtues, prudence and fortitude and justice and prudence, these were virtues meant to strengthen or cultivate a certain kind of character that can remain apathetic toward these goods that can't actually make you happy. The Stoics were really good at both recognizing and communicating just how much of our lives are outside of our control. We can make really good plans for our future. We can be really good at our jobs. We could be really good students. We could be trustworthy friends. In short, we could just sort of do everything right, and things can still go horribly wrong. If you suffer horrible misfortune, can you have a good life? The Stoics were adamant, yes, no matter how unfortunate you are, no matter how much misery or suffering you have, it is possible to live a truly good life, because the virtuous person acts virtuously with a kind of excellence, even in hard circumstances. The virtuous person, because he's cultivated apathy toward fortune and its false goods, is not dismayed or overwhelmed by his misfortune. So he remains with his apathy, he remains sort of even keel in adversity. And with his virtue, he acts with excellence even in these difficult circumstances. Is this person happy? No, he's not a happy person. But he's living the good life because he has a noble character, and he's acting with excellence, and he's not overly dismayed by his bad fortune. One way to think about this Stoic ethic is in the context of their broader cosmology. Now, I don't want to say too much about this except to say that they were deterministic. They were even fatalistic, with one exception. They thought that we do retain some kind of interior freedom. We can control our reactions to things. But about external events, they thought that everything in the universe was totally determined. And you could see how that is of a piece with this call to apathy. If everything in the universe is totally determined, then nothing, no contribution that I make to affairs is really mine. I might intend a certain outcome as I act in the world. But what will be, and not because of me. And so I can still act excellently. I could still do the right thing. But if I'm a good Stoic, I give up this need to really be an influence on things. I just try to do my best, and fate will determine what actually happens. I think there's a lot of good in the Stoic system. I myself am not a fatalist, but I think that this focus on virtue, of course, is something that Christians of all kinds, especially Catholics, will see a lot of similarity with, a lot of solidarity with. And even this call to detach ourselves from material possessions and from chasing status, chasing honors and power. You know, the Stoics thought that these things were not good at all. You know, remember, indifferent. I think the Christian has to say, they're not indifferent. You know, everything is good in a Christian worldview. Every positive thing is good. Evil is just the corruption of goodness. So all of these material goods that attract us, they do so because they really are good. But they're not that important. They're not high goods. So we shouldn't have this undue attachment to these things. We shouldn't pine after them. Christian ascetical practices are meant to detach ourselves from these external goods, so that even if we, in a good life, make use of them and are even fond of them in certain respects, we're not attached to them. We don't place our hope for happiness in them. So the focus on the virtues, the call to detachment, and then this sort of what we might call kind of Stoic toughness, I think is also worth emphasizing. This idea that you can act with excellence, nobly, even in extreme adversity. I think that too is a message that, is true and that a lot of people need to hear. Don't wallow in your misfortune. Focus on what you can control, which is your own character. I think all of these things are good. Stoicism is, it's a noble philosophy. It really is. And it's, so it's no surprise that early Christian thinkers, perhaps even St. Paul, there's evidence that he knew the Stoics in the book of Acts, for example, Acts 17. Early Christian thinkers tended to admire Stoics very much. But I suggest they didn't get everything right. And that's not a surprise. I already told you that. And this is a Catholic sort of event, so the Stoics aren't Catholic, so of course they didn't get everything right. But here's what I want to focus on. I don't think they're so good about our relationships with other people. I think they badly misunderstand the sort of social nature of humanity and the way in which the best sort of life for a human to live has to be a social kind of life. Now, it's not like these guys weren't at all interested in social affairs. Marcus Aurelius, for example, talks about the brotherhood of all men and doing his best as in his capacity as emperor to act justly for people. Didn't do a very good job, came to the Christians, but that's a different story. So it's not like they were totally unconcerned with other people. But think about it like this. It's one thing to have a sort of humanitarian impulse, right, to care about humanity. And it's another thing to care deeply about this person and this person and that person, to sort of risk your own happiness on another person, like a marriage, for example, where in making these promises to each other, you open yourself up to disastrous heartache because you've attached yourself to this person in such an intimate way. So the humanitarian might care about humanity, but the lover cares about people, individual people. So I suggest that the Stoics often said great things at the level of humanitarianism, but not so great things at the level of relationships with individual people. There's this kind of famous line from Epictetus, for example. So when you have if you have a wife or a child. Think of it or her as like a nice shellfish or a truffle. You know, very nice in their way, but not very important. Of course you'll do good by your wife. Of course you'll do good for your kid, but don't get too attached. Because when they die, you won't be very sad. So I don't like this. I mean, I think that there's something about a Christian agape, Christian neighborly love that does get sort of stuck in with other people. Remember, even Jesus cried at the tomb of Lazarus. There's something about the suffering of other people, the suffering of those who are very close to us, that ought to evoke sadness. So the Stoic would suggest, well, when you're sad, you have suffering. And the goal of life is to rid yourself of all suffering. So don't put yourselves in situations where you will be made sad, which means don't care very much about your friends and family. That aspect of Stoicism, I think, doesn't resonate with normal people. It resonates, I think, with a lot of especially career-minded people. And maybe there's a lot of them at this university. Not in this room. I'm not trying to put anyone down. But that you could see how this obsessive focus on one's own career, one's own wealth, one's own status. The Stoic recommendation to disregard personal relationships might come as like welcome advice. But I don't think it's open for the Christian. And I think most people have this sort of deep, maybe intuitive recognition that the good life for a human being is a social life. So their lack of concern for individual relationships, that's not so good. Their fatalism, I don't think that's so good. This is not a talk about metaphysics, so I don't want to give an argument for that. I think that our experience of our own freedom suggests that the world itself has contingency baked into it, that a fatalistic universe just is not accurate to our experience of contingency. Stoicism is not hopeful enough. I think, along with Plato and Aristotle and St. Thomas and Boethius, that what we really want is beatitude, happiness, and not just the absence of suffering. And that happiness, joy, blessedness, beatitude, it's something positive. It's not something negative in the sense of an absence. The absence of suffering is fine, but that's not really what we seek, this extra thing, happiness. So I call this, the criticism here is that that the Stoic view is, in the end, hopeless or desperate in the sense of despair because of the way it sets the bar too low for what human beings really want. And then I'm also concerned in a more contemporary register, I'm concerned about the way in which Stoicism can foster a sense of social isolation, can foster a sense that as long as one has a kind of control over one's own appetites, is not living under compulsion, that the sort of tech-immersed life in which we can single-mindedly focus on our goals is a good sort of life for a human to live, and that Stoicism gives us the discipline we need to suffer in that isolation and that drive. I think Stoicism encourages us to sort of linger in that isolation. We have, you know, I think COVID lockdowns, I think, had a lot to do with this kind of increasing the fragmentation of our social fabric. Increasingly, as I've read Brad Wilcox's book on marriage, I think it's called Get Married. He's a sociologist. He has statistics about households of one, you know, just how many people in America, adults live on their own. how few people are getting married anymore. I think that Stoicism is a good philosophy for people who live by themselves. Okay, so what's the alternative? Well, let's keep the good parts and discard the bad parts. And so the tagline or the title, Agape over Apathy. Our hope for happiness does indeed lie in our relationships. First and foremost, with God. And secondarily, in our love of neighbor, those closest to us, due to our affective and psychological limitations, but ever always reaching outward, outward, outward to encompass all persons. This opens us up to suffering, but it's the suffering that we are called to. Secondly, while tranquility is a good thing, in what all things considered, tranquility is good. We need to set our aim on true happiness and not mere tranquility. And that requires hope, because true happiness, even if you recognize that that's what you really want, you might convince yourself that it's impossible to attain. So the virtue of hope comes in here to keep that desire for happiness plausible to us. And then, of course, we need to reject the fatalism that would leave us a sort of resigned to a world in which everything that happens is just going to happen and it has nothing to do with our input. And so we're just, you know, why care about the suffering in the world when we can't do anything about it anyway? So we need to reject that sort of fatalism and replace it with an emphasis on providence. Providence suggests, in contrast to fatalism, that while there is a kind of order to the series of events in the universe, it's an order that allows for freedom, and it's an order that is to the good. Boethius is a representative of this alternative. I want to say just a little bit by way of introduction before I close here. Boethius died in the year 524, and he was a Roman senator. You know enough history to know that that is a very late time in the Roman Empire. In fact, it's not really worth calling it an empire at that point. Rome, at the time, was ruled by Gothic kings. In Boethius' own day, King Theodoric. Theodoric was an Arian. Boethius and the Western Catholic Church were, of course, Nicene, anti-Arian. And yet Theodoric did have a kind of policy of religious toleration for a long time that allowed Boethius and his fellow Catholics to carry on with their own religious practice side by side with Theodoric's Arianism. The Arians had their own churches and all. Theodoric was also prudent in the sense that although he maintained control of his kingdom through his army, he administered sort of the affairs of state through the Senate. So there was this sort of lingering kind of maybe a slightly nostalgic kind of air about the institution of the Roman Senate. It still had real choices to make. It still could set policy to a certain extent, even though Theodoric was really the one in charge. Boethius was a senator from a senatorial family. He became consul twice. He had two sons. His sons became consuls. I mention this because he was kind of a big deal, simply as a politician. But then he was also a big deal in another way because he was just fantastically learned. He seems to have read everything there was to read, not just in philosophy and theology, but in poetry, in epic poetry and drama, in mathematics, natural sciences, music theory. He knew lots and lots of Aristotle, lots and lots of Plato, seems to have read all the Stoics. So a man of letters. He had a conviction that since he knew Greek and since he had read so much, he had this obligation as a Roman to distill the wisdom of Greek philosophy and translate it into Latin to pass on to his countrymen. He writes in several places, very, very noble-minded here. He's not, don't picture the sort of scholar alone in his study. You know, when he gets time out off from the Senate, he sort of indulges his private hobby as a kind of form of leisure. Now, even his academic or scholarly work was still ordered to this sort of public, the public good. Despite having enjoyed a very close relationship with Theodoric for most of his career, he was eventually accused of treason, and it is a pretty interesting story, but I'm not going to tell it for time's sake. He probably was not guilty of treason, but probably had treasonous thoughts, and Theodoric found out about them. He was accused, convicted without a proper trial, and sentenced to death. The Consolation of Philosophy, which is considered Boethius's masterpiece, was written while he was on death row, not in a modern prison, you know, concrete and steel bars, not in a dungeon. You know, he couldn't, if he had his hands manacled to the wall, he wouldn't have been able to write. House arrest, probably, but nevertheless, a death sentence. He knew his days were numbered. And he writes this book in which he describes how philosophy can bring comfort or consolation when, not just when one is about to die, but more importantly, when one's life has fallen apart, whether that's a death sentence or something else. Boethius, as an author, has a lot of humility. He portrays himself as a character in this book, in dialogue with a great lady, Lady Philosophy. And the character, Boethius, is a really shameful, self-pitying wreck of a human being at the beginning of the book. Lady Philosophy enters his cell, starts a conversation with him. She's on the one hand kind, but can also be severe. You know, she's a hard teacher, but always has Boethius's good in mind. And by the end of the book, Boethius seems to have indeed found some consolation. It's a sign of humility that he would portray himself that way, how he was at the beginning, before the cure, and not just all the noble lessons he learned from philosophy at the end. But remember, Boethius, the author, Lady Philosophy is his character just as much as the character Boethius is his character. So he knew, the author, knew all the lessons that Lady Philosophy had to teach him. He had to remember. So the book that he gave us is in turn a way for us to remember the kind of wisdom that is embedded in the Western tradition of philosophy and the kind of help, the real life practical help that it can offer us in our own lives. The first half of the book you might think of as almost totally a Stoic treatise. Lady Philosophy is trying to detach Boethius from his concern for all of these external goods or goods of fortune that are outside of his control. After all, he's lost everything, and he's miserable. She says, you're miserable because you placed your hope for happiness in those things that have been taken from you. If you knew that those things can't make you happy, then the loss of them wouldn't dismay you. But in the second half of the book, Lady Philosophy turns a corner. She goes beyond Stoicism. Instead of recommending tranquility as a goal, she says that we desire nothing less than beatitude, perfect happiness. She rejects Stoic fatalism in favor of a world providentially governed by God. She comforts Boethius by reminding him of the very close, good relationships he has with friends, with his family. She calls friendship a most sacred good. So he seems to get everything right. He takes all the good things about Stoicism, that call to virtue, that tough-mindedness in the face of adversity, that detachment from external goods. But then he gives us back this focus on social life and the way in which human happiness is to be achieved in social life. She rekindles, Lady Philosophy, Boethius, rekindles hope for happiness and not merely a desire for the absence of suffering. And then she takes that kernel of wisdom in Stoic fatalism, which is that there is a power higher than we are that ultimately dictates what happens in the universe. But she switches blind fate for divine providence and comforts Boethius with the thought that God, while allowing for things to, while allowing for people to suffer misfortune, to suffer pain, that God's providence means that nothing in the universe is finally evil. No misfortune, no suffering, nothing is finally an evil. Everything can be turned into something good, or something good can come out of everything that we experience as bad. Boethius died in 524, and there has been some controversy ever since about how serious a Christian was he. And one of the reasons why it's a question that always comes up again and again and again is because while he wrote theological treatises and was involved in theological controversies of the day, the Consolation of Philosophy has nothing in it that is explicitly Christian, unequivocally Christian. He talks about God a lot, but it's the sort of way of talking about God that a Platonist might be okay with. So the question is, why would a Christian theologian at the very end of his life turn to philosophy for comfort and not Christian theology or simply Christ himself? It's a question I think that is ultimately unanswerable because we don't know enough details about what else Boethius might have been intending to do. You know, the Consolation of Philosophy primes him for theological consolation, and there's some intratextual evidence that Lady Philosophy is trying to hand Boethius off, so to speak, to something higher, something more than philosophy. But that's all speculative. We just don't know enough. What I think that we should focus on, though, as a way of settling the question of Boethius's faith, is that he was actually revered as a martyr in the city of his death, Pavia, Italy. Revered as a martyr almost from the beginning. There was a church, St. Peter in the Golden Heavens, that was under construction in Boethius' own day. Boethius is interred there. Centuries later, there was an inscription placed above his tomb. Saint Boethius, martyr. The Boethius' cultus was confirmed in the late 19th century by papal edict. And I don't remember exactly, or I don't know exactly when he was officially listed in the Roman martyrology, but at least in the, by the 2003-2004 edition, he was in it. I checked an edition from the early 20th century, and he wasn't listed in that one, and I'm not sure why. That's a scholarly question. It doesn't actually interest me that much. But the Catholic Church considers him both saint and martyr. And I think that's sort of enough for me. And the reason I sort of close with this is that as a philosopher myself and a Catholic, I take a great deal of consolation from the pagan philosophers I admire the most. And in my case, that happens to be Aristotle and Plato. I think that they have a lot to teach me. In some cases, It corresponds with what I accept by faith, but in some cases it enriches my faith. It adds levels of detail, of subtlety, of nuance that I don't see merely by, say, studying the articles of the Christian faith. So philosophy does indeed bring great consolation, and I don't think that a a Christian intellectual needs to be embarrassed about that or insecure about that in any way. The ultimate consolation, of course, comes elsewhere, but that's not the topic of this talk. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to hopefully a rich Q&A. So.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.